Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today we have a really unusual episode, but I'm pretty convinced that you're going to find it as fascinating as I have. So today we have Nico Miko with us, Con Langer, and for most of my audience, that word won't mean anything to begin, but we will explain as we go. So I'll pass over to Nico to introduce yourself, and then we'll get into the main focus of today.
Do you mind if I do like a quick, like I can do an intro in Viosa and then like in English?
Yes. Yeah. Let's do it. Let's do an intro in Viosa.
Okay, cool. All right. Un Discord server fu Viosa. Akurat un vona Pennsylvania land un ergo na compu doi matin. Akurat un kaku per compu person. Aon ima un ergo in Florida land. Doko ergo plus food. So, hello, my name is Nico. I'm 28. I live in Pennsylvania in the United States. I run the Viosa Discord server. I've been speaking it for about 20 years. It's a constructed pigeon. And yeah.
So how did you get into this whole world of constructed languages or conlangs?
Right. So when I was in, it's kind of just always been a curiosity for me. I think when I was younger, I want to say like middle school or something like that, I took an interest in like learning foreign languages. And I had a habit of like writing down words and playing with their spellings and, you know, drawing from different like families. Like I was learning German for a little bit, but I didn't have access to a lot of German resources. So I would just like experiment with like doing what my child brain thought was Germanicifying, Germanizing,
I love it.
like English words or Latin ones or whatever, without really having any idea what I was doing. And then when I was in, yeah, I guess when I was like later in middle school, I started learning Russian, and that introduced me to a whole world of like grammar and syntax and things that don't exist in English. And the exposure to that led to more of that kind of sandboxing where I started building. I had worked on a conlang called Uvaloy and something, I think a couple other ones. Like I've built like little art langs so that I could, you know, like have my characters speak in a foreign language in like D&D or something when I was dungeon mastering and stuff like that. So that's how I kind of got into conlanging more generally. And then I ended up at some point like on the R conlang subreddit. And I met some people that had started a Skype group. I hung around there for a little while, and that's where I met the Viosa people.
So for people who only know one language, can you just briefly tell us a bit about what is involved in studying linguistics more broadly? Because like that's a step beyond like learning a second or a third language. That's kind of digging into the deeper structures of all languages in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. So, well,
it's a huge question.
Yeah. What was the first part of the question? I'll start there.
Well, what is linguistics?
What is linguistics? Okay. So linguistics is the study of language, basically how it works on a whole bunch of different levels. So the many different levels that you can cut it along include like the actual sounds and mechanical production of those sounds in the human body. You have the cognition of words and meaning and like the psychological process of attempting to speak and understand. You've got grammar, which is once you have sounds and ideas put together, you put them together more. You have like a system for how these sounds and ideas work together. And so linguists study how people talk to each other in all of its in all the different facets of that, from the phonology, the syntax, how words change over time, that's diachronics, across all dimensions and levels of the human experience, basically.
Do any linguists study the creation of new words? Because there's such a power in making up a new word when you have a need for it and doing it well.
Yeah. I think that's a curiosity for a lot of people. I feel like the people who would probably that would fall into their domain the most are sociolinguists, because when you're talking about language change, you're talking about the most current actual mode of communicating, and the way people do that is by interacting with each other on, for instance, in person or on social media, et cetera. So this process is like inherently collaborative. For linguists, it's unusual to study one person's own invention of language. It's much, much more interesting when multiple people agree on something. And this is something you see like all the time on social media, where like the forefront of language is debatably kind of like Twitter adjacent spaces, where people are just throwing things at the wall, and sometimes they stick, and nobody can figure out who is the first person to use an expression, right?
Hey, there's a theory in language of language acquisition that there's a critical window from like, I don't know, 1 to 5 years, where if you don't learn to speak during that phase, like there's a high level of brain plasticity or something, that's your opportunity to learn your first language. And if you miss out on that for, abuse or neglect or deafness or something, it can be hard to come back. And I've got a theory that there's a second critical window during adolescence. And you see this in adolescent subcultures, that they often spontaneously form variations on their native language that create like a little in-group dialect. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I find that so fascinating. I think the first window is like undeniable, because we have cases where people have like unfortunately like grown up without language, which is, I don't know, almost unimaginable. And I think I agree that there's like, well, so the argument about the first critical period is that it's like biological on some level. Like where like the brain literally is doing something different in that time period than it is later in life. And I think that is more or less true. And I think that later critical periods, because I think it's reasonable to argue that there are perhaps many, might have more to do with like social development and the context that people are living in. But also, people's brains aren't fully developed until they're in their early 20s.
Yeah, that's I think it's partially biological with teenagers, that they have a if they're in the right environment, then there's another opportunity to branch out their language skills.
I definitely, and I totally agree. When I took my second language acquisition course in college, one of the things that we talked about was that like the clear cause of these critical periods is not so obvious. It's usually not like a single source. Like there are biological factors, so the brain development. And then there's things like when you're in adolescence, you're also in school, where you see the same people every day, or 5 days a week for 8 hours at a time, which is a lot of exposure to like gain rapport and build a shared vocabulary with people. And as soon as you leave that structured environment, either to go to another one for a briefer period of time at college or join the workforce, like that exposure is different and also distracted by your responsibilities at work.
And it's going to be interesting to see how the formation of kind of walled garden online social communities interacts with language evolution, because I mean a good example of that would be the kind of Gen Alpha gamer speak that has everyone outraged at the moment, the Riz skibbidi toilet kind
Yes,
of.
I love it.
So let's build up to talking about Viosa, because that's what got me really interested in your work. So the next thing we can talk about is, what is a pidgin language?
Sure. So a pidgin language is a comp at its heart is a combined language. There are two important aspects. So first, it's a combined language, and usually it is partially improvised. These two things have lots of like consequences, but those are I think the two most important things, is that it's a fused language of more than one language, and it's usually improvised on some level. So when the example that I like to use is, say you are it's like the 1700s and you're a Russian sailor and you land in Norway, but you still have to say you still have to you still want to like trade and sell your fish, because it takes a long time to get wherever. So You land in the port, and your ship full of people meets like a bunch of people on the dock, and they're talking to each other and they're pointing to objects and saying, like, Fisk, they're in Fisk. And the Russians are like, okay, может быть, это Фиск. Like they agree on the right, they agree on words just by gesturing until enough people are doing this activity that it achieves some level of stability. So everybody more or less agrees that the word for fish is fisk, regardless of which language the word is pulled from. There's some level of agreement. And then you achieve what's called creolization when multiple generations of people, like when it depends on who you ask, but a pigeon becomes a creole when somebody grows up speaking it natively. And then it's no longer improvised, but it really is a reflection of a system.
And I think there's a language in the southern US, at least a dialect that's difficult for native English speakers to fully pick up, that is a Creole that's descended from a pigeon.
Right, like in New Orleans,
Yes.
Louisiana. Yeah.
That's the one. And another good
Yeah.
example is in Papua New Guinea, that every little village speaks their own unique language, but there's a common simplified trade language that pretty much everyone can speak so that they can travel and get basic communication done. So that's a kind of evolved compromise between two languages when they collide together. What is a conlang?
Well, so conlang is short for constructed language. So conlang is a very, very broad category. Most people have heard of Tolkien, like, Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's Elvish or his Dwarvish or whatever, which are like fully fleshed out structured languages. So some people create them for artistic purposes, which is more or less what his languages are, or like Na'vi in the Avatar movies.
Or Klingon.
Yes, exactly. Where they're meant to express a particular aesthetic. There are also experimental conlangs where people are really exploring grammar or syntax or some feature of human language by experimenting with it. And then there are international auxiliary languages like Esperanto, which are designed to be like a more neutral vessel for people of different cultures to communicate with one another. So that, for instance, instead of everybody learning English, which people see as like kind of imperialist, and it is, instead of everybody learning some one particular locality's language, you create one that is grounded nowhere in particular and is therefore kind of everybody's. So those are the big categories. I think under experimental languages, you have like logical languages. There are people very concerned with like categorizing things as explicitly as possible and really exploring the limits of that. So there's
Is
a huge variety.
Toki Pona a really good example of a conlang, an experimental conlang?
I would say so, yeah, because it's well, its goal. Sonia Lang's like stated goal with Tokipona was to like make people's like lives and cognition better by simplifying their thoughts, essentially, by reducing it has a set of around 100 words. I think it's just over 100 words that are
And you
in the
can learn it
language.
in
And
basically an afternoon.
exactly, it's one of the biggest draws of it. Yeah, it's like simplicity. It's very, very popular because it's like easy to get started. And the conceit is that you, in order to express more complex concepts, you have to think about, how to use these little units that you have at your disposal rather than trying to find the perfect word. You just kind of put the things together as they seem intuitive.
Now, I've spent some time living in Australia's capital city, which is a designed city. Like the whole thing was drawn up on a blueprint and then kind of dropped on the landscape. And that's really different to when a city just grows organically from like humble beginnings. And I'm wondering if there's a similar kind of impact with languages if they evolve versus if they're just designed by one person sitting in a darkened room with nothing better to do.
Yeah, I think it's a totally different experience because a lot of people, for instance, come together around Esperanto, which was at its core, it was like one person's idea, and there was always like an early community around it. But the same thing with Sonia Lang's, where it was her idea and people have stuck to it like fairly closely. But so you could say that there's another category of conlangs that we're approaching, which is naturalistic conlangs, where some element of it is mimics the formation or evolution of natural languages. So Viosa is, I think, the best. I mean, I don't know about the best. I don't know. It's the best example for me because I have so much experience with it. I can tell you how it relates to naturalism in languages. So Viosa is a constructed pigeon. It's a conlang pigeon that started on Skype, and the conception of it was essentially that nobody is going to design anything about the language. Everybody got together in video calls and agreed that they wouldn't speak English with each other, and they would take timeouts occasionally to like pause and, calm down if they got frustrated or whatever. The experience of building a language that way is completely different because it's collaborative and unpredictable.
Was it
And
fun? Was it fun, like in those early
incredibly,
days?
it's incredibly fun. Yeah, I was there for like the I think I started in like the second week of its inception, so very, very, very early. And yeah, it was a blast. It was so difficult to learn the first couple of words, but once you like the first moment that something clicks is like an incredible feeling because you're used to translating when you're learning a second language, and when you instead your brain just like makes the leap for the first time, it feels incredible.
And I'm really interested in the idea that this kind of it's almost like a language game. It's a collaborative language game. And I really wonder if something like role playing, like Dungeons and Dragons, could be done in a context where the primary rule is that you're not allowed to use any pre-existing languages. And again, getting back to Lord of the Rings and like this made-up elvish language that kind of created added to the aesthetic of this world, that could actually be the core of the game of developing a language together. I mean, imagine like the magic spells are the words, but you have to like, I don't know, I'm grasping at an idea here, but it feels like a possibility for culture building.
I agree, actually. I think, I mean, I think that's a fabulous idea. I would love to do that with other conlangers. Like just because I mentioned I used to DM, I've like thought of ways to integrate playing with language into the game. For instance, like if I have elves that speak a particular language, I could reward players for picking up on specific words that I'm using. Like if I'm using a system, then other people can learn it. And then that is like, first of all, very fun, but also you can reward it with like say in experience in game, or as the case may be, you can explore that idea with people. I think the one the major caveat with this is that conlanging is kind of it's kind of an inherently isolating activity, just in this that it's hard to find it. You don't often come across people in your everyday life who are into it as a hobby. And
Languages
like I
normally a means to an end, like it's a tool for achieving some other goal. And yeah, the particular community that the Osso and other like conlang projects drew together individuals with very specialized interest in language first, and then everything else as a side effect.
Yeah, and I have had people like in my like close friends or whatever who like really took an interest in Viosa, and like I taught them for a while, but they weren't like the same kind of like obsessed and hungry for language that I am, and that a lot of other Viosa-gen are. Like a lot of people who are in the community really are stuck in it because like not in a bad way, but like embedded within it because they like live and breathe it every day, and not everybody does.
Now, this brings me up to another potential like rising motivation for people to develop new communal languages. Now, have you heard of Argos, or I don't know if it's pronounced Argot. I'm sure it's French. It's got to be Argot.
I think I've heard both. I think I've heard Argo and like Argit or something like that, but
So
remind me what they are.
what is an Argo?
I don't know.
Oh, I can tell
I
you.
think
I can
there are,
tell you. So
please do, please do.
there are a language that's designed to be uninterpretable by casual listeners of the bulk of the community. So a really good example of this is Polari, which was an
Yes,
argot
exactly what I'm
developed
thinking.
by gay men in London, like before the World Wars. So it was a way for them to communicate with other gay men and like check out if somebody else might be gay that they've met by just dropping some of these words in. And if they pick them up, then you're like, oh, now you can have a conversation in Polari and avoid being detected. Various criminal groups have developed them. I think there's a big prison somewhere in Central Europe that has its own language that only the prisoners speak. And I'm curious if this is my kind of theory that in a world of growing surveillance and particularly automated surveillance, that the ability for a subgroup to create their own language on the fly could be a countermeasure to that, particularly if the group is so small and the languages are changing so rapidly that it's difficult for whatever surveillance systems to keep up.
I find that idea so fascinating. I actually think about it all the time because, well, for a number of reasons. So I often wonder, like, if somebody were to come into, say, the Veosa server with absolutely zero information about, like translated information about what each word means, how much would they be able to interpret our communication? And I think there are a number of factors that play into that. So the intelligibility. So some of the properties of Veosa are strongly influenced by people's first languages because it's kind of how they think about and conceptualize languages by default. And a lot of people speak languages besides English as their first language, but a lot of people do speak English as well. So there are a lot of patterns within Veosa where if you are watching closely the division of semantic space, or sometimes the way that people order words, or certain assumptions about how language works in the first place are derived from somewhere familiar and recognizable. And so, if your goal is to create an argot that specifically is a countermeasure against surveillance, it's perhaps one of the first things you would need to discuss is like L1 transfer, like grammatical and syntactic and say phonological transfer from your first language. Like you need to, like I think the first step would be creating an awareness of that, like the importance of that, like second order thought when designing or evolving the language.
I guess there'd be different models as well too. So one approach would be to always be changing the foundation of the language, like so that the whole community can keep up with like small changes, and that would potentially make it a moving target to crack. The other thing would be to wait until it gets cracked and then completely rebuild a new language. It's like, okay, you've taken that language from us, we're going to start a new one. And it's such an easy process for us to do. It's almost like flu viruses changing their antigens every year.
Yeah, I think that so I think that is so fun. The first approach where things are constantly changing reminds me of like a password of the day kind of vibe. The thing that strikes me about it is that you have some considerations with like how quickly information about what changes are going to happen when can travel. And if whether or not they're small enough units that people can spontaneously make the jump between one, say, version, one, the version from one day to the next, like you either want it to be so different as to be incomprehensible from one day to the next, or so intelligible that it can constantly be changing and be different in different places and at different times. But you want it to be so intelligible to the speakers that they can pick up on when it has changed without needing any further information, because humans are great at doing that.
I also thought about Pig Latin as a kind of argot. And it's a language game, but it applies a consistent rule to a spoken language that if you do it fast enough, somebody who hasn't practiced that can't keep up, but any word can be modified on the fly. And I wondered if English that was built on a phonetic alphabet, maybe a simplified phonetic alphabet, would allow you to like swap sounds, like a vowel shift on a schedule.
Yes. I find that really interesting. I think that is a yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking was like if your goal is to make it change from one day to the next in a predictable but not intelligible without further information kind of way, on a schedule makes a lot of sense. Vowel shifting on a schedule is such a is such an interesting way to approach that, I think.
Well, I would love to play around with a consonant shift as well.
I think actually, I think a consonant shift would probably be even more effective because in Viosa we have had several, we have individual speakers who have different have had consonantal like drifting over time that makes them like notably within the community difficult for other people to understand. And this isn't like them intentionally, they're not designing these changes. What has happened is that they two or three of them would get into calls very regularly all the time where it was like kind of a lull in the server's activity. So over time, especially their consonants drifted. And so N's became like nasalization on vowels and they delabialized pretty much all labial consonants. So P, B become like H, which if you're not briefed on this in advance is like shakes people off for sure. If they're used to one version of the language, consonant changes actually interrupt cognition on like a level that is maybe not is unexpected. It's like quite surprising.
But if you have your ear into it, you can adjust kind of like I'm trying to think, like if you go to somewhere with a really heavy Scottish accent, they're still speaking English, but the way the sounds are applied to the language is so different that when you're just thrown into it from a more standard form of English, you can get completely lost.
Right.
But
I totally agree.
you don't have to relearn the language, you just have to relearn the sounds, and then
Right.
you crack the key. You crack the code, sorry.
And what is interesting about this is I think that in itself is a trained skill, like being the time it takes you to learn a new accent, for instance. These people love to do accents. They love to there are people who are really good at picking up on exactly how to speak like a Scottish person, even though they are not Scottish or, Australian, say. And that in itself, like the more that you do that, the quicker you become, and really the further the gap between you and people who don't do accents. Like people who like have never really tried or just never got good at it are usually like kind of amazed at like how well people can like imitate each other's accents. And so I
And
think
it's an
that if
intuitive skill, isn't it? You're not sitting down and like figuring out like the exact place of each vowel on the vowel sound graph and then rehearsing it. It's something you do intuitively by interacting with that form of the spoken language.
And I think taking this idea to the Argo level where you have the language changing on on a schedule, if you have a community of speakers, like say, hundreds of them who are really, really good at adapting from one day to the next, that system becomes even more secure because then you can make bigger leaps between days. And it's like just progressively, as time goes on, people build that skill and then they build a community around that skill. It becomes even more impenetrable to outsiders, I believe.
And again, it links back to it having an aesthetic. Like every selection of, phonemes, the sounds, and how they're stitched together. I mean, think about the different aesthetics of like Scottish versus like New Zealand English. They have a real sense of place and community to them.
And personality, I think. What's was this? This has come up a few times that people, multilingual people, tend to, in my experience, when I've talked to them, report that speaking in their second or third language, especially if they have a lot of fluency, but even if they don't, they tend to feel like they are literally a different person. Like they're performing a different personality, or they're experiencing the world differently, or they, their cognition is on some level different, which I think is such an interesting and beautiful idea. And in this like scenario where you have an Argo changing from day to day, I wonder what it would be like to experience a totally different sense of place and person and personality and cognition from one day to the next because you're like changing your accent all the time, or reorienting to different syntactic structures. Like there's all kinds of implications on like identity, which is really interesting.
Well, that brings me up to a question I wanted to link back to. We live in an ever more digitized and globalized world, but I wonder if you have any thoughts about the intersection between that technology and language and culture. Like, what's your perspective on, the trends and the possibilities in this really strange world that we find ourselves in?
Yes. So I have a couple. So I'll take like, there are two categories of these like interaction technologies that I'm thinking of. There's like Twitter, social media, where everything is very scattershot, and one person's like, 16 character tweet can make it out to millions of people within moments. And then there are very, very intimate settings like VR chat rooms where like you're as close to being in person with somebody as possible. You're limited in the number of people that are there and can be exposed to that information. So, like, what is really fascinating about the scattershot, like, broadcast format, say Twitter, Blue Sky, etc., those kinds of platforms, is that often humor is the like carrier wave for new pieces of language. And people joke about this often, but they start using a word, say, an expression, ironically at first, and then it becomes like a serious part of their vocabulary. And I think I don't I think I mean I think with the speed of communication naturally going up, the ability for one person to reach many like instantaneously, with that being accessible to people, I think it's like way more unpredictable what things are going to make it into everybody's everyday language than perhaps it was when everybody was getting their language from the same, say, television shows or radio channels,
Do those
things
new
like that.
words that do manage to propagate die out fast as well?
Often it seems that they do. There are some that like really stick for a long period of time, and I'd be hard pressed to like be able to list them off the top of my head. But I think, and there's a number of factors that go into whether or not they survive for a long period of time. Like if they have a large emotional impact, for instance, like they're very funny, or they describe something that a lot of people resonate with, or they just generally have utility that isn't filled by another word, that word will survive for longer. But more kind of vapid productions, like they're talk to anybody who studies like the history of memes. Like they die very quickly. They're like everywhere for a little bit, and then you just don't hear about them. And then years later, somebody will be like, "Oh, do you remember like troll face or whatever?" And people will be like, "Oh my God."
Here's a provocative suggestion. People alive today who create new words have vastly more cultural impact than people who create like new novels.
Why?
Well, a word is a tool and it's functional and it's reproducible. And you can pick it up if it does something for you that like if it meets a need, you can just use it straight away. Whereas a novel, like who's got time to read a novel anymore? This isn't the 19th century. We're not sitting around in our parlor with like the whole winter to kill.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. Like there's an investment of time that goes into absorbing somebody's like creative energy if it's like many, many words versus like a like I said, a single word. Like I think like an incredibly powerful word production mechanism is literally put a word next to an image, and that will be that that will stick for people forever. Potentially, as long as the combination, like as long as the image is evocative enough and the word makes sense with it, like the more like vibey coherence there is between those two things, like you have like a real possibility to like leave the world with something just with like a single word tweet. Yeah, I think to some extent, I think you're right. I think you're right.
On the flip side, automated language translation technology, do you think that has sunk the end user case for auxiliary universal languages like Esperanto, that they're never really going to take off ever again?
I don't know. That is like I think such a fascinating question because when Esperanto was first created, there was a real need for it between it was if I recall, he was I forget exactly where Zamenhof was, but he was in a neighborhood that was like full of like Slavic people and Jews and Germanic people, and so they really were just between a rock and a hard place trying to communicate with each other, and so he was trying to solve a problem that had not been solvable up until that point. I think machine translation has a long way to go before it totally can supplant people's natural creativity and desire to do that.
And you need reliability. Like if you're negotiating a contract or a treaty or something, the language has to be absolutely, it's not even just a matter of translation, it's a matter of understanding, which goes beyond just the language. And I think it's like it's a parallel case to AI in a lot of other applications. If it's just, a jokey picture of a weird cat, who cares if it's got, one too many fingers? But if it's flying a plane or driving a car, then that use of AI has to be, 99.99999% right. And I think you've got a similar issue with language translation. For some situations, if it's just a postcard to grandma, you can afford to take a risk of that not translating perfectly. But there's
That
so
feels
many.
like the worst thing to imperfectly translate with a bot, too, is like if I start to
But yeah, if it's an international peace treaty or something, and you're relying on Google Translate to make sure everyone's on the same page, then the consequences of that could be really, really disastrous.
really disastrous. I think that there's a number of factors too that but it's not just like the performance the performance of the software and its like consistency and its like perfection or whatever, but it's also its ability to process feedback immediately. Like a translator, like a physical human translator, can respond to changes in body language as it happens across a room and like correct misunderstandings that a machine won't be aware of until it can also do that kind of thing. And I think that people are probably more skeptical of machines adjusting to their discomfort than they are of a person who is like suddenly apologetic and like, I'm like, I didn't mean to offend you or whatever, you know.
And you're right, spoken language has so much more communication to it than just the words. So does that make, and also spoken communication using digital infrastructure is now so important. Like we're chatting from the opposite sides of the world casually. And I almost wonder if there's an opportunity for a universal auxiliary language like Tokipona to evolve under that scenario that, anyone on the planet you can have a basic conversation with using a very simplified language that's tailored designed from the very foundations that anyone can get their mouth around it. Because I mean that's a big barrier too. The growing up being able to produce certain sounds and even hear certain sounds in different languages can be a real barrier to learning a different language later in life.
Yeah. And I think actually, now that you point out Tokipona, that's actually a great example of a language whose, I think, purpose has kind of morphed over time. Like it was initially like a psycho, it was like a cognitive, psycholinguistic experimental language, I think. And then, like, over time, it's become so popular that I would not doubt that it could function as an international auxiliary language, even though it has like clear limitations. I think the ability for a couple of people to sit in a room together and enjoy lunch together while talking in Tokipona, I think that is very, very possible. I think
Do you think we
that
need a big competition for this purpose to like use Tokipona as an inspiration, but now that it's been used so much for so long that we've got an idea about what could be done better, that there could be a competition to come up with a next generation kind of equivalent that is designed to function as a universal, simple language?
Yeah, I think I don't know a lot about Toki Ma, but I think it is explicitly that, which is like a slightly more, I don't want to say mature as in Toki Pona isn't mature, but it like has some of those considerations in mind, like being able to count in, like all of the numbers instead of one, two, and many. Right. But I don't know. See, I think you would find within these communities a lot of pushback against the creation of a like more evolved version of a language. I think the a lot of the there's always the, like a schism anytime that somebody has that idea, like, okay, well, let's just do a better version of this one. Esperanto and Ido had the exactly that situation happen where there was a disagreement and the community split into Esperanto and Ido because there were some changes that people wanted to make, and there were other people who were like, this is functioning already. All you're going to do is, divide the community or, alienate people who have already latched onto it, et cetera. And so, like, sometimes it feels better almost to start completely from the ground up rather than to like try and push a project right in that new direction, like, because you have the potential just to divide the existing community. That can be like very
Exactly.
damaging.
Yeah, you end up with Catholics and Protestants or Shias and Sunnis at each other's throats over, which way we chop our apples for breakfast.
Exactly.
Now, if there are other people or communities out there thinking of creating and evolving a language like Viosa, are there any takeaways from the experience that any advice that you'd put out in the world for people who are thinking of replicating that kind of experiment?
Yeah, for sure. I have a few. So the one, I think the two rules, the two main rules that we followed, especially at the beginning, were that we would not do any kind of translation, and that if you could understand, if you could make yourself understood, and if you could understand somebody, then you were speaking Viosa. And so the implications of especially that last one are like, if you can understand somebody, they are speaking to you. And a lot of, I mean, like, the fundamental experience of learning a second language is having an idea and being corrected. And, whatever intuitive idea you had is like probably a little bit off. And so like somebody who speaks the language better will be like, no, this is what you mean.
Yeah, they can clarify or negotiate how the communication is happening.
Exactly. And so when you totally let go of explicitly correcting what appear to be mistakes, then you have spontaneous drift in meaning and spontaneous drift in sounds and like grammatical structures or whatever that are beautiful and individual. You know what I mean? Like when the community allows other people, like when everybody in a community allows other people to speak differently than they do, kind of like magical things happen. Like it's a very, very unique situation that you find yourself in, because it also encourages you to listen more closely to other people. If it takes some effort to understand another person's expression because it's different from your expression, you're just generally more thoughtful towards that person, which has positive effect. And when your assumption about somebody's speech being different is no longer that it is wrong, there's just like a weight kind of lifted off of the relationship to a certain extent. And that's something that we are sort of like struggling with a little bit now within the Viosa community, that, I mentioned earlier that there was somebody whose speech has like diverged significantly from everybody else's, or, a small group of people whose speech have diverged in roughly the same direction. That has an alienating effect that we are kind of like dealing with at the moment. Like, it can be like really hurtful to be singled out and like, for somebody to point out like, haha, you talk different from everybody. Isn't that weird? And on the other hand, we have situations where new people have been n new, like thousands of new people have come in, and say, even if like there's dozens of them that are currently learning, there are a lot of them that have agreed on some things that are decidedly different than the language as it's been spoken for 10 years. And so there's a debate within the community about like, well, we can certainly understand them, but are they speaking Viosa? Because it has had so much momentum, and we have this ethic about like listening to the existing speakers, and
Did
there's all kinds
Viosa
of
start out as
considerations.
purely spoken? Like it took some time before details were written down. And do you have any broader thoughts about spoken versus written languages? Like how does that very simple difference in technology change how people interact with language?
It's a simple difference, but it's huge. So I think we did start out kind of writing things in the Discord and in Skype at the time, Skype chats, but the majority of the formation of the language was done through video calls. And the reason that this was possible was because at the time, Skype had just released like video calling for free for everybody, and so we could get into groups and actually do this. And it was like we were kind of right. We were in exactly the right place at the right time to do that. And I think it was very important for us to do that. So I remember there kind of being an ethic that, like, if we were going to make Viosa, we would kind of prioritize video calling for it. And if we were going to teach and learn Viosa, we were going to prioritize video calling. So it's intuitively a very, very different experience because you're having to do some interpretation when somebody's talking and you're listening, but you have no written reference. Your brain is doing a lot of different work than it is when it's like recognizing symbols that it already knows.
I almost wonder if you could get a either online or in-person community that was doing this kind of project, that you could make it semi-structured. So like there's a series of word sets such that each time you come together, each individual person has an assigned concept that they have to bring a word for. And then but the sets of them are designed in a way that you can actually build different kinds of simple sentences from them, so you can actually use them interactively. And then every time you come back together, you expand the vocabulary.
I think that's a very, very doable. That's a very, very doable like language game. I think that's super, super doable. Like I could easily see that happening as like, like in like a college club or something like that. Yeah. Because I think one of the things that we kind of have also struggled with a little bit is like overrepresentation of certain contribution languages, like Japanese and Russian and Norwegian are very like top of the list in terms of the number of words that entered Viosa from those languages. And that wasn't like a, I don't think it's necessarily a problem. It's just that there are also like many other small and perhaps dying languages that we would love to be able to use words from. So our Japanese speaker self switched to contributing from Ainu for a little bit, which is an indigenous Japanese language. And I think a couple of other people have like considered have like contributed like Native American words, but
Do you think there's
I
an
forget.
advantage in allowing people to create new words completely from scratch, just based on their own, intuition and feeling? If that was distributed amongst the group, it would create a sense of buy-in. It's like I've gifted this to everybody, but it's still my baby. So the word for red, for example, that will always be something close to me. So it kind of connects you more deeply to that particular community.
And what is interesting about that is that it kind of implies stability over time, that that word will always be that word. I first of all, I love the idea of coining words from intuition, like a priori with, or yeah, a priori with no grounding in an existing language. I think it kind of in its on its own deals with that overrepresentation or kind of like air quotes imperialism of like one language having a bit more dominance within the community. So I love that. And the idea of contributing a word and having it stay the same over time is something that we've run into as well, because people do get attached to the words that they coin or the words that other people coin. We have a situation, and we have a situation in Viosa where one of the Irish words that was contributed at the very beginning was hain, which m means one. And over time, this kind of merged with Ain and German Ein. So now when people read EIN, they think, oh, Ein, it's the German word. And the Irish identity that was originally there is kind of lost to time just because of the interpretation. And so the question that prompts is like, do we enforce like originalism in like do we enforce that like the original form of the word will always be the form, or do we enforce like do we embrace language changing over time and risk kind of wiping away people's existence essentially because the Irish speaker is no longer in the community, at least not as deeply. So like by allowing the words to change and morph over time, you kind of like are letting go of like people, which is like a really, it's a balance for sure.
It brings up an even more interesting up thought. If you had a group of, I don't know, 10 to 20 people speaking a minimal constructed language like Tokipona, they could each have a subset of words that are assigned to them, and it could be their job to like be the dictionary, to be the word, you know, the French word police, that department of like true French words. And if somebody dropped out of that community and was replaced, like you had an optimum size for the community, that new person could bring in new versions of those words. So everyone would be welcoming them into the group by learning to use their new versions of that, 12 words, which is, if you're only changing people out occasionally, like, maybe once or twice a year, that would be a manageable burden of language acquisition. But it would create a real sense of buy-in to that community.
I like that a lot, actually. Like the idea of just have, because that's something that we struggle with as well, which is like finding your corner of Viosa to be yours. And if we say like everybody gets their little plot of land, like everybody gets their 12 words to contribute and like kind of take dominion over, that is a really interesting proposition. Something about that that I think is kind of fascinating is that you are, by doing that, kind of cutting up the semantic space into discrete units that are like well defined. And one of the forms of drift that happens often in Viosa is that one person has a word for, say lamp, and then another person has a different word for that. And then those two people come together and they're like, well, we both have words for this thing. And then what happens is that one word takes on a slightly different sense of the word. So lamp might be anything that glows. And then another one might specifically be an electrical lamp. Which if part of your goal, like if we're thinking about the Argo situation and keeping things like rolling, if part of your goal is to be unpredictable, ungovernable in terms of your language, then like you have to do the opposite thing, which is to allow those neatly cut up boxes to change.
To move the boundaries on the definitions. It's such fun. It is so
It
fun
really is.
once you
This
start
is
thinking about
actually
all this
quite thrilling.
stuff. So let me think. We probably are getting close to the end of this. So can you recommend any resources for people who are interested in learning more about the Conlang and linguistics world?
I mean, I hate to recommend Reddit basically, but the subreddit for conlangs/r/conlangs is like a great place to start if you are new and unfamiliar. We have, I forget what the name of the conlang, the CDN, the conlang Discord network. I guess that's what it's called. I don't know if they have like a custom URL or anything like that, but you can find that on the subreddit as well. They're kind of closely connected. Viosa has, tons of conlangers within the community, and we're always welcoming people who like kind of just lurk and like to talk about languages. And I think the best thing that you can do is to join like a community for a conlang to kind of understand, because all of them have different ethics, all of them have totally different experiences to offer. So I think just literally go to Wikipedia, look for conlangs, and start going down the list, like joining communities, popping in, saying hello, and seeing what they're about. Honestly, I think associating with other people is the best way to learn more.
I've really enjoyed the Con Langery podcast. Con Langery podcast. It's hard to say that clearly, but I'm a huge fan of podcasts, so that's part of my bias there.
Yeah, no, I like that one as well.
And yeah, there's a couple of prominent YouTube channels, the Con Lang Showcase and Jan Masali. Jan Masali, Con Lang Critic, has some cute short videos that explore different languages and I don't know, just get your mind racing at all of the possibilities.
Absolutely. Yeah, we love Yami Sili. He's, excuse me, they very, very, very good. Very, very good content. Such good videos.
And do you have any people in the Conlang community that would you would recommend that I do an interview in the future? Particularly Tokopuna people might be interesting because there's so many of them.
Yeah, there are tons. There are tons. The first person I would recommend is Sonia. She's active on the Discord server, and if you can get, if you can get some of her time, I'm sure you would find it valuable. I'm sure your listeners would find it valuable. I certainly would, but Sonia Lang would be great. And also, if you do, they have an enormous Discord server that if you just join it and ask around, I'm sure you could find somebody who would be happy to talk to you. The Yam easily also has, like, there's the Conling Critic Discord server. You might be able to get their attention. Those would be my
I'm on it. I'm on
recommendations.
it. I'm on it. They're good
Yeah.
recommendations. So,
Thank
what's the
you.
best way that people can learn more about you and your work if they're particularly interested in tracking you down?
Me as an individual, I honestly don't advertise that much for myself as an individual. I would say come onto the Discord server, onto the Viosa Discord server, and just at me, just at Nico Miko. As far as like my individual career, I think my no no I think my internet personality is mostly grounded in the Viosa community.
No, that's okay. I like to thread that out there, but I know I talk to a lot of, I don't know, really unusual and obscure people who don't necessarily want to, the burden of maintaining a huge online presence. So that's totally understandable.
Yeah.
And that makes me even more appreciative that you took the time to come and talk to my very different kind of audience, but I think they are going to find it absolutely fascinating. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.